Okay, well, I'm so angry. I could kill him. You know, when I was a little kid, I used to watch Perry Mason with my grandma. And my grandma was, you know, that German woman with the big hands that squeezed the grapefruit. Well, she was the daughter of a pastor. And we'd sit there, just the two of us, watching Perry Mason together. I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. And it was my favorite thing to do. It was kind of a real big adult show, you know. And at some point in the show, almost every show it seems, somebody would say something just like that. I could kill him. I'm just so angry. I could kill him. I'm gonna kill him. I'm gonna wring his neck. And my grandmother, the sweet little pastor's daughter, you know, she'd go, "Oh, never say that." You know, and sure enough, by the end of the movie, the guy was charged with murder because he had said, you know, "I'm gonna kill him." And you know, my grandmother, I mean, that was good advice. And I try to put that advice into practice in my life. Whenever I feel like killing someone, I try to remember to never say so, to never actually admit it out loud. You know, these days, I still like to watch Perry Mason reruns, but I'm a big Law & Order fan. And you see the same kind of thing on Law & Order, except usually it's during the investigation and the police, the cops show up at somebody's house, you know. And this is a guy that had all kinds of motive to kill whoever's dead now. And, you know, usually the person will say something like, "Oh, he's a horrible man. I'm glad he's dead. I mean, I'd like to congratulate the guy who killed him. But I didn't do it." Now, you know, the reason these people willingly tell the police how they feel about this guy is because it's not against the law to hate someone. It's just against the law to kill them. That's the way it works in America. But you know what? In God's kingdom, it works a little bit differently. In God's kingdom, it's not only against the law to murder, it's also against the law to stay angry with somebody. And that's the kind of radical idea that Jesus gave his followers. Today we're continuing in our series on the lessons that Jesus taught his disciples, and we're still in the Kingdom Handbook, the Sermon on the Mount, that is a kind of handbook about how to live as citizens in God's kingdom. And last week we began this new section called the Kingdom Code. And in it, Jesus tells his followers that being forgiven doesn't mean that we can suddenly live a life of lawlessness, or that suddenly it's okay for us to live a life of lawlessness. In fact, the king of the kingdom, Jesus, actually heightens the requirements of the law, or at least our understanding of those requirements. And he tells us what the law really means. The law had been given years and years before through Moses, and some parts of God's law given earlier than that even. And people had kind of grown comfortable with a certain interpretation of what that meant. And Jesus came along and said, "You know, excuse me, but I'm the author of that. Can I tell you what I had in mind?" And he starts to clarify what he meant by some of the principles and the commandments that we find in the Old Testament law. He tells us what the law really means, not just the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, the intent of the law. We finished last week with Jesus' statement that your righteousness must surpass that of the scribes, the experts in the law, and the Pharisees. These were the most carefully righteous people of that day. And I'm sure that his followers sat there for a minute wondering how that was ever going to be possible, how they could even remotely become even as righteous as the Pharisees, let alone more righteous than the Pharisees. But what Jesus really had in mind was that although the Pharisees were very concerned about obeying the external requirements of the law and actually doing everything that the law said, they followed it in a very legalistic, very wooden way, and it was a joyless way. And Jesus called them actors. He said, "You guys are actors. You're putting on a play. You're not really what you act out. You're just playing a part. That's all you're doing." They cared very little about what God really wanted. What they cared most about was doing exactly what God had told them to do. Did you ever have a situation like that where maybe it was one of your kids or somebody you worked with where you told them what to do and they followed it like exactly what you told them to do, but they didn't stop to actually think what it was you wanted? So, you know, they brought you that bucket back, but it was empty, you know, or whatever it was. And that's the way the Pharisees were. It was a hollow, shallow obedience because they did exactly what God told them to, but they weren't doing what God wanted them to do. And so Jesus called them actors. In fact, they'd even added a few rules onto extra rules. And some of those rules didn't even do what God wanted at all. They were exactly opposite of what God wanted. And so Jesus sits down with his disciples, his followers, and he tells them the meaning of the law, the meaning of the kingdom code. And the code is there to honor God, not just with your actions, but also, besides your actions, with your thoughts, with your attitudes, and with your motives. The kingdom code is a lot deeper, and it's a lot more personal than the law of any country. It delves into the innermost part of a human being, a place that no man, no other man, can possibly judge. We don't know other people's attitudes. We don't know their thoughts. We don't know their motives, but which God intimately knows about each one of us. So what follows here, his statement about your righteousness surpassing the scribes and Pharisees, what follows are six comparisons. Comparisons between external performances, acting out a play like the Pharisees, or internal obedience to the law. You know, what we really want is both. We want external reality that matches an internal reality. And not just following the letter of the law, but completely missing the spirit of it. So Jesus gives six comparisons as examples. And probably he could have gone through every point of the law and done the exact same thing. But he pulls out these six as an example. And he deals with anger. He deals with lust, with lying, with divorce, with revenge, and with hatred. Those six. And in each case, he calls us, his followers, to commit ourselves not just to obeying the external requirements of the law, but also to allowing the kingdom code to govern our thoughts and our motives and our attitudes. So today we're going to start with the first of those six contrasts as Jesus teaches us about anger. So we're in Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 21. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to people long ago, 'Do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.'" Now, the people he's talking about are the people that long ago were sitting at the base of Mount Sinai out in the desert when Moses came down with the Ten Commandments. You remember one of them was, "Do not murder." And so he says, you remember a long time ago, people were told, you know, they heard that. God told them, "Do not murder." And in fact, the rabbis had added this little phrase that kind of summarized the teaching of the law in another place. And that was that anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. And in fact, that judgment, if you've read that part of the Old Testament, you know that that judgment was death. If you committed murder, then you were put to death, usually by stoning. And so whoever murdered was subject to judgment. And that's what you heard, and that's what the people long, long ago heard. So he begins with the Old Testament going back to the law as it stands, to the code as it stands. And then Jesus, being aware that people could look at that and say, okay, well, I'm going to follow the letter of the law, and I'm going to conform to that, but I'm really not going to let it affect my attitudes, my emotions, and my motives. Being aware of that, Jesus pries the lid off a little bit, and he adds something to it. It's not a new commandment. It's the same commandment. It's just an application to the inner man instead of an application to the external behavior of men. And so Jesus says, that's what you heard, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. It's the same phrase, subject to judgment. And he says that you are guilty as well, if you are angry with your brother. Now, you know, that's kind of an amazing thing if you stop to think about it, because anger is an internal sin. It's a sin of the heart. I mean, I can see what you look like if I think you're angry. You know, I think Bob was talking about a couple weeks ago where, you know, your face turns red and the veins start popping out in your neck. And, you know, my dad had this little doll when I was growing up that smoke actually came out his ears, you know. And I've never seen that happen with a real human being, but maybe I've just never gotten anybody quite that angry. But, you know, you can see when somebody's angry, but, you know, maybe they just had like a jalapeno pepper and they're not used to eating jalapeno peppers and you get a similar kind of response. I can't look into somebody's heart and tell what's going on in their head, can I? Nobody can. And, you know, sometimes people will go, "I'm so angry with you." And then that's a good clue, you know, that they're that that's what's going on inside them because they've said that out loud. But otherwise, I can't tell. You know, really. But God can. And so here's God saying, this is not just about external obedience. This is about inside, what you're like on the inside. If you're angry, if you retain that anger against someone, then against your brother, then that is sin, and you're subject to judgment. You know, even these days, we have real difficulty prosecuting what we call hate crimes. Remember, that's a big controversy about, well, how can you really tell if there's hate in their heart? And yet God can tell what is in somebody's heart. And this is not a crime that gets punished by people or human courts. It's a crime that gets punished and executed as punishment by God, judgment by God. You know, there are a couple misunderstandings about this verse, and so I want to make sure as we go past this verse that we stop to undo some misunderstandings that I've heard, you know, pretty commonly out there in writings and books and things. One is that this verse is saying that anger is the same as murder, or that anger is just as bad as murder. Okay, now, I want you to look at the verse carefully because it does not say that. Nowhere does it say that murder and anger are the same thing. Nowhere does it say that murder and anger are just as bad. What it says is that murder and anger are both sins. Both of them come under the judgment of God. And it's clear from other parts of the Bible that not all sin is the same in God's eyes. However, all sin qualifies you for eternity away from God in hell. All sin, any sin. And in that respect, they're the same. But in every other respect, they're different. Now, I just want to make this note, okay, to all of you, because just for the record, I would much rather that you be angry with me, okay, than anything else. They're not the same, okay? So it's important to remember that. The other thing is that this is not saying that anger itself is a sin. When you just read this verse, it sounds exactly like that. If anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Well, that means that I was subject to judgment about 18 times already this week, right? Because I was angry there. Okay, so boy, I'm messed up. But you know, there are other verses that make it clear, and we're going to look at a couple of them, that anger itself is not sinful. Jesus himself was angry. There's at least one instance where it says that Jesus was angry. And then there's also a verse in the New Testament in Ephesians that talks about being angry without sinning. And so it is possible to be angry without sinning. And we're going to look at those verses in a minute. But I think that anger initially is just a response, not a choice. It's something that happens to you. It isn't something that you choose to do. I don't know about you, but rarely does it happen that when I get angry, that it's because I sit down and go, okay, let me see. Let me think about this now. That wasn't a very nice thing to do or say. Maybe I should be angry. Okay, I'm going to go be angry. Oh, I'm so angry. You know, it doesn't happen like that. We don't think about it. We don't choose. It just comes, right? It just flows right out of the inside of us. Now, I think that, you know, maybe the reason we get angry so often and over the things that we do get angry over is because we are fallen human beings. And so in that sense, maybe that initial anger is sinful. But I really think that anger, that initial anger, is more of a temptation than it is a sin. It's not a sin in the sense that I make a choice to disobey God. When it first strikes, it's a temptation to sin. And it's what we choose to do with our anger and what we choose to do because of our anger that makes it sinful. As we're going to see from later verses, it's unresolved anger that is sinful. And one of the main reasons that it is because it leads to sinful actions. Jesus continues with a really classic example. I mean, murder would be one possible action, but usually, you know, I don't know if anybody here has ever committed murder. It's pretty unusual. But this next thing, probably all of us have done. Jesus said, again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish court, the council that met. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now, how many of you, to be honest, how many of you have ever said Raca to somebody, okay? Okay, there's a couple of you, okay. And, you know, you Aramaic speakers, that's really important to not say that. But Raca is an insult. In fact, it has that ch at the front, you know, and it's on purpose. It's a word that kind of sounds like spitting on somebody. It's like Raca, you know, and so It basically means empty-headed, something like that. It means not very bright, okay, except it's a derogatory term, and it's basically an insult. And so is the Greek word moros, from which we get our word moron, okay, which means fool. So when you call somebody a haka, an empty head, a stupid idiot, or a fool, then this is an insult. And he's saying that when those kinds of insults come from a heart that's angry, when we feel angry and then it explodes out in insulting speech, in degrading speech and put-downs, in negative things about each other that we shouldn't be saying, he says those things are sin. I think what he's doing here, if you look at the structure of this, is that he is giving you two pairs of things. He's saying, you have heard that anyone who murders, that's a sin, but I tell you that anyone who's angry, that that's a sin. And again, and I think you should understand the phrase, you have heard, anyone who says chaka is guilty, but to the Sanhedrin, that he's going to have to answer to that Sanhedrin council of the Jews. But I tell you, and you need to kind of understand that phrase again, I tell you that anybody who says fool is going to be answerable to God, to hell fire. He uses the word Gehenna. And Gehenna is an interesting word. It's a valley that's near Jerusalem, and it was the dump, okay, for lack of a better theological term. It was the dump. It's where they took all the refuse of the city, and they burned it. And the fire just kept going the whole time. It burned constantly. And when they had, back in old times, before Jesus' time, when they had criminals that were executed, they threw their bodies, instead of burying them, they threw them in Gehenna, into that fiery pit of trash as it was burning. And so from that usage of this valley, it came to be a picture for hell. And they used it as an example when they wanted to say, like, you know, that person's going to hell, they'd say, they're going to end up in Gehenna, because that was the place where the fire kept burning. And that's the picture that Jesus uses here. He uses that word Gehenna. And so he says, you see the two pairs there? You heard this, but I tell you this. And you heard this, but I tell you this. So he's saying, you've heard about murder, but I'm telling you that anger is also wrong. You've heard that insulting your brother will get you in trouble with a human court, but I'm telling you that insulting your brother gets you in trouble with God. Okay? Now, he's not saying that if you call your brother a fool, that you're going to end up in hell. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that if you call your brother a fool, that's a sin, and it deserves hell, just like every sin does. And what he's trying to do is underscore the magnitude of what you're doing. He's trying to say that's a sin. It'd be easy for us to go, oh, yeah, another sin. But he goes, no, that's the kind of sin for which hell exists. And because you put your trust in Jesus, if you've put your trust in Jesus, then he's paid the penalty for your sin. And so you're not in danger of going to hell because you're in Christ and he's saved you from that. He's given you forgiveness. But he still wants to underscore the magnitude of what you've done. That is a sin that's worthy of hell. Because it's really easy for us to think of, well, I didn't murder anybody today, so overall, it was a good day. You know, did pretty good. There's this movie at the end that I like, and at the end of the movie, they say, so, you know, we made it our goal that I was going to stop killing people. Maybe we're setting our sights a little high, you know, because this guy was a little violent. But, you know, that's the way we think. Well, I didn't kill anybody today, so I'm a pretty good guy. But how many people did we insult? How many people did we let our anger, our perturbation get in the way where we couldn't help but say something derogatory about them? He says that's sin. That's the kind of sin that sends people to hell. And if it were not for what Jesus had done for you, that would be the penalty for that sin. God takes it seriously when we're angry, when we hang on to our anger, and takes it seriously when we allow that to leak out of our mouths in what we say to each other. And why does he take it so seriously? Well, I think it's good to remember that it's, I think, partly because we are missing this person. We're losing sight of the person that God loves and that God created when we are angry with them and when we put them down. We're demonstrating a kind of impatience with him that is so different than the incredible patience God has showed us. You know, as we think back on our own lives, we think of all the second and third and fourth chances that God has given us, all the things that God has said, yeah, that was an ugly sin, but you know what? I forgive you. Let's start over again. I wipe that slate clean, and I completely love you, and you're going to be with me forever. And after everything that God has forgiven, for us to turn around and go, that dunderhead, Raka, you know, I can't believe he'd do that. And God looks at us and says, didn't we just have a conversation kind of like this about you? And I let you go. So I think that's why God takes it so seriously, is because it's not recognizing what God, the person God has made, and it's not recognizing what God has done for us. Before we move on to the next part of Matthew, what I'd like to do is stop and take a look at what the other parts of the New Testament say about the issue of anger. And there's actually not that many verses in the New Testament about anger, and a lot of them are about God's anger towards sin, his wrath, his just wrath against sin. But there are a few that talk about our anger with each other. And here's just a little survey of some of the things that it says. In 2 Corinthians, Paul was writing to this church in Corinth. And, you know, he was a they were a church kind of like the churches that we know and love. They were full of all kinds of problems. And so he writes to them and he says, look, I'm about to come and visit with you, but I'm a little scared about our visit. Said, I'm afraid that when I come, I might not find you as I want you to be. You know, you might not be really where I'd like you to be. And you know what? You might not find me as you'd like me to be. You know, what he's talking about is they'd like to have this joyous reunion of, oh, here comes Pastor Paul back, and we're all together, and we're all enjoying being together again. Isn't this cool? And Paul's thinking, there's some serious problems we need to talk about when I get there, and it may not be the happy reunion that you're expecting. He says, I fear that there may be quarreling and jealousy and outbursts of anger and factions and slander and gossip and arrogance and disorder. He says, from what I've heard, this is what I'm thinking might be going on in the church, because people have come and told me that that's what's happening in the church. And so I'm a little concerned about our upcoming meeting. These two words that are in here, outbursts of anger, is one of the words in the New Testament that gets used for being angry, thumos. And the other word, slander, is an example of when we allow that anger to actually kick into speech. It's a very interesting word. You probably will recognize it. If I tell you the Greek word, you'll know the English translation. It's blasphemeo. And it's where we get our English word blasphemy. And when it's used, when it's an insult against God, we call it in English blasphemy. When it's an insult against another person, then it's called slander or an insult. And so that's the same word, though. It's basically saying negative things about each other. Put downs. Rumors, whatever it is that comes, in this case particularly, in Matthew, out of an angry heart, that we're angry about it, we hang on to that anger, and then we let that seep out in what we say. So here in Corinth, they're having that same issue. In Ephesians, Paul writes to these guys, and this is the verse I was telling you about. He says, in your anger, do not sin. Now, this is the same word that is used in Matthew for anger. And so here it is possible to be angry and to not sin. And this is how we know that not all anger is sinful. But he says, in your anger, don't sin. And then he gives us a couple clues as to what that means. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold. So two things that anger could happen with anger that would be negative, or I mean that would be sinful then, and anger hanging on to it would be sinful. One is that you let the sun go down while you're still angry. Now, the pastor that I grew up with, he always used to say that meant, like, don't be angry after dark. And so if you get angry at 8 p.m., too late, you already sinned, you know, just too bad. You're already. Now, I think he was maybe joking, but really the meaning of that phrase is don't let it linger. Don't let lots of time go by without resolving that anger. And I don't know that it matters whether it's overnight or after dark or in the morning or whatever. I think the point of the passage is don't let it go. It needs to be resolved. And the other thing is because it gives the devil a foothold. It gives Satan a tool that he can use to pry us apart as husbands and wives, as brothers and sisters in Christ. as co-workers, when we have that kind of anger, and any person is holding that kind of anger in their heart, it gives Satan an opportunity to drive a wedge between us. And so if we do resolve it quickly and we don't allow Satan to be able to use it in destructive ways, then anger is not necessarily sinful. There's a great danger in anger, and whenever that pops up, it should let us know that this is something we need to pay attention to, but in and of itself, it's not sin. Ephesians 4, later in the letter, Paul says, so what you should do is get rid of all this stuff. Just clean house. Get rid of all bitterness and rage and anger. Those are the two Greek words that are most commonly used for anger, and here he uses both of them. Brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Just get rid of it. It's kind of the Nancy Reagan, just don't do it, or just say no kind of thing. Just get rid of that. It's not proper for the church. Colossians 3 says a very similar thing. Now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these. Anger, rage, there's those two words again. Malice, slander, same word. And filthy language from your lips. It's just not something that belongs in a fellowship of believers. 1 Timothy 2 says, I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands in prayer without anger or disputing. Does it strike you as interesting that he'd pick that out of all the things that he could say? I mean, he didn't say lying or adultery or gossip or gluttony. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't say envy. He said without anger or disputing. And I think the reason is because Satan knows that this is a tool that he can use in a church to drive people apart from each other. And that's why he says, as you come to worship, lift up holy hands without anger. Have your anger resolved before you come to worship, because it's just not proper in the fellowship, in a context of worship, to be holding that anger in your heart. And then James has a whole slew of good advice. My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be, and he has three things to kind of guide our lives. Quick to listen. Slow to speak. Okay, well, there's a couple of my blue already. And then slow to become angry. Because man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. See, we think that anger is really going to do something for us and really help us. And James says, it's not. It's an empty promise. It doesn't bring about the life of righteousness that God desires for the people that are in his fellowship. Well, let's go back to Matthew and see what Jesus said. So he said, you heard, don't murder, and I'm telling you, don't be angry. You heard not to say chraka, or you're going to get in trouble with a human court. I'm saying, don't insult your brother, or you're going to be in trouble with God and not just a human court. And then he goes on and he says, so therefore, he starts to say that basically what we need to do is reconcile. And he says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there, remember that your brother has something against you. Now, the picture is, here's somebody in the temple, they're bringing their sacrifice and their animal, and they're coming to offer that up on the altar, and they went to great pains to get just the right animal, and I don't know if they even killed it yet or anything, but at the altar, you know, you're pretty close to the thing being killed, and you're well into this, okay? It would be like saying, if you are there in church at the offering, you know, like halfway through the service, and there you remember that your brother has something against you. A little odd, because it's in a passage about anger, but it's talking about not you having something against your brother that you're angry about, but rather if your brother has something against you, and therefore you know that he's angry because of something that you've done to him, if you realize that, leave your gift there in front of the altar. Just leave it. Just walk away. Put down the sacrifice and step away from the altar. First, go and be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. So he says that it's so important to have this anger reconciled, especially here again in the context of worship, that you need. It'd be better for you to stop worship so that you can go and reconcile with your brother and then come back. You know, this verse shows the importance of reconciliation. It's important enough to interrupt worship with God. You know, I thought about this week and I wondered why is it that important? I mean, that seems pretty important. And why couldn't I just finish the worship service and then go be reconciled? And you know, I think the reason that he's saying this is because that kind of anger, that kind of dispute and conflict, when it's left unresolved in the church, keeps people from being able to worship. It's a block, it's an impediment, and people can't concentrate on praising God when they're angry with their brother. James says it this way. He says, with the same mouth, we bless God and curse our fellow man. And that isn't right. And I think deep down in our hearts, we know that that's not right. And so it's really hard for us. And so all the way to church, we're kind of going, rada, raka, you know, fool, moron, you know. And then we walk in and want to praise God with that same mouth. And it just doesn't feel right. And so we shut down our worship because we're angry. And what this is saying is, if you know that you've done something to your brother and he's angry because of that, and it, you know, it's the fault is on your side of the table, then don't leave him hanging out there where he can't worship. First, go be reconciled to your brother so that you can then come and present your offering, and so he can present his as well, and both of you can worship God. So seek him out, apologize, ask for their forgiveness, and seek to reconcile your relationship. You know, very interesting here, the responsibility here in this particular passage rests not on the offended party, but on the offending party. It's the party who has committed the sin that's responsible here to go find the person that he committed the sin against and to be reconciled with them. Now, it doesn't mean that that's always the way that it has to happen. In fact, later in Matthew, Jesus talks about exactly the opposite. And he gives instructions to the people who have been offended. He says in Matthew 18, if your brother sins against you, then you go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. And if he listens to you, then you've won your brother over. So here is exactly the opposite case. In other words, the responsibility doesn't rest just with one side or with the other. The responsibility for reconciliation rests with both sides, both the person that committed the offense and the person who has been sinned against. Both of the people are responsible for bringing restoration and reconciliation to that relationship. So if your brother sins, go show him his fault. And if he listens, then you've won your brother over. And I think this conversation is one that is seeking mutual understanding. Maybe I made a mistake here, but it sure seems like, you know, you stole my new Porsche, and I'd like to know why you did that, because that doesn't seem right, you know. And maybe I got it wrong, and it wasn't them or whatever, but I'm seeking restoration, reconciliation with that person. If he listens, you win your brother over. If he does not listen, then take one or two others along. Don't give up. Keep going back. This time take somebody else so that more than one person hears this conversation. And then if he refuses to listen to all these people, then tell it to the church. And the passage goes on. If he refuses to listen to the church, then this person is not really interested in being part of your fellowship, and you should not have him in your fellowship. But basically, I just think it so rarely gets to that point. There's all these other steps to be able to go through to try to bring reconciliation and restoration of the relationship, because that's what it's for. That's what it's all about. And both parties are responsible to come together and patch things up. So as far as possible, to be able to agree on what was done and what was wrong and what each side did in that, and for each side to take responsibility for what they contributed to that conflict. Now, you know what? I know, both from practical experience and from many, many things that people have said to me, that we don't want to do this. You know, we just don't like it. It is a onerous task. It is something that we really don't want to have to do. And it's something that is also a lot of hard work. If you've ever done it, it's not easy. It's hard work. But it is very important. More important, Jesus says, than getting to the worship service on time. And you all know there's not many things that are more important than that. God says this is important. It's more important than you showing up to worship me, is that you take care of that first before you come and worship me. Not only is reconciliation important, but it's also urgent. And as Jesus goes on in the last section, he gives us kind of this mini parable, if you will. It's kind of a story, and I think we could apply the story just exactly to our situation. excuse me, but I think he also really means more than just than this specific example. So he's giving us an example that has broader implications as he tries to say that reconciliation is urgent. He says in verse 25, settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court, and do it while you are still with him on the way. You know, apparently it wasn't uncommon for two people to walk to court together when they were about to be in a lawsuit against each other. And he says, you know, if it's at all possible, settle out of court. That's what you want to do. Okay, and, you know, here's Jesus offering good lawyerly advice and saying, if you can do it, settle out of court. That's what you want to do. Kind of the opposite of Doug Llewellyn, not take him to court, but settle out of court. And that's what he's saying. When your adversary comes and somebody's suing you, they want to take you to court, the very best thing that you can do is settle with them. Otherwise, he might hand you over to the judge. What if he prevails? If he prevails in that lawsuit, then you're not, you know, it's not up to his grace and his mercy of the person you offended, but rather, it's now the judge's responsibility. And the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. And I tell you the truth, you won't get out until you have paid the last penny. In Jesus' day, when somebody lost a lawsuit and they owed then a great amount of money to the other person and they could not pay, they'd throw them into debtor's prison. And they basically worked in that prison until they paid off the debt that they owed to the prevailing party. And so Jesus, I think, again, is not so much trying to give us legal advice here. He's trying to give us a picture of two guys on their way to court. And one of them is about to lose. And when he loses, he's going to go to jail and he's going to have to pay. And he's not going to get out of jail until he's finished with that. The penalty is sure and certain and it's coming. And I think what he's trying to say is not, again, legal advice about how to conduct our business in court. What he's trying to say is he's underlining the situation that we're in here with one person who's angry with another one. It says, when you have unresolved anger in your heart, when you hold that anger in your heart, or if you've sinned against your brother and you've caused anger, you've never tried to patch things up with them, then basically you're asking for it. That's what Jesus is trying to say. There are consequences to that. Just like there's consequences to losing a court case, there are consequences to leaving these things unresolved. Reconciliation is so urgent that is urgent because you want to be able to avoid those consequences. And so if you sin against a brother, God's not going to send you to hell. That's not what it means here by you're not going to get out of purgatory or hell until you've paid the last penalty. That's not at all what this is talking about. It's talking about a court case. And in the same way that those consequences are irrevocable, in the same way the consequences of holding unresolved anger and sin in your heart, conflicts between you and your brothers and sisters in Christ, that the consequences to that are irrevocable. If you sin, God will lovingly discipline you to capture your attention and bring you to two things: repentance, which is Godward, and reconciliation, which is manward. Your relationship with God and your relationship with man needs to be restored in repentance and reconciliation. And so, you know, God kind of gets the stick out and taps us on the shoulder, you know, to see if we're paying attention. Those are the first consequences of sin. We start to notice some effect. And then if we're not paying attention, what does God do? You know, you guys have seen this before. He goes and gets a bigger stick, right? Now, this is not God being mean. This is not God being angry with our sin. This is not God punishing us for our sin. Our sin has already been punished. It's been completely paid for in Christ. So what is this? Why does my life fall to pieces if I hold on to sin in my life? It's because God's trying to get my attention. Which of you, if your kid was not about to run out in front of a car, and you had a big stick in your hand, okay, which of you would not throw that stick at him or push him out of the way of the car with the stick or whack him to get him to move, anything to keep that car from hitting him? That's the way God's discipline is with us, is that he is lovingly urging us not to continue in sin because the consequences of sin are so destructive. It's going to kill us. And so God says, you know, if you're not going to listen to the polite invitation, then I'm going to tap you on the shoulder. If you don't listen to the tap on the shoulder, I'm going to tap you, rack you on the head. You know, if you're not going to listen to that, I'm going to get that stick and push you out of the way because I don't want your life to be destroyed by sin. And I will do Because I love you, I will do what it takes to get you out of that. That's what he's talking about here in this passage. Again, he's urging us to reconcile. When we have anger in our hearts, or we've been the cause of someone else's anger, that we, either case, we have a responsibility to go to that brother, that sister, and try to reconcile, because it'll get in the way of our worship, it'll destroy our fellowship with each other, and it'll destroy us. And so to avoid those consequences, it is important and urgent that we reconcile, and that we do so quickly, and not allow Satan to have a footing where he can destroy us and our fellowship. As we wrap up here, what I'd like to do is close with some little practical advice about anger. Now, these are not explicitly from the Bible. I pulled out six things that I thought would be helpful to kind of remember as we're dealing with the issue of reconciling anger, or dealing with anger, or reconciling with our brothers. And, you know, as I said, these aren't explicitly from the Bible. And even worse than that, I'm not a psychologist, so I'm expecting all kinds of email this week from the psychologists in the group. Please go easy on me, boys. And but what I'd like to do is step out on a limb here and give you some extra-biblical, non-psychological advice about dealing with anger in your life. Okay? Number one is, anger is an alarm. Anger is a warning light. It's a red light blinking on the dashboard with a loud siren that says something's wrong, and we need to treat it as an alarm. We need to find out what's setting off the alarm. It means something's wrong, so we need to find out what that is. And it might be somebody else's actions that are wrong. Maybe it's injustice that creates that anger in us. Maybe it's a personal attack. We've been wronged or sinned against. That creates anger in my life, too. You know, I hate that when that happens. Like all warning systems, however, you can have false alarms, and anger can be the same way. You can get angry even if you haven't been wronged. That happened to anybody? And it ever happened to you where you thought you were wronged and you got angry? You know, and you didn't have a choice in the matter. It just happened, right? And whatever it was in your mind that you thought was done to you, you were still angry about it. And it's kind of like the alarm going off. And you need to find out what's wrong. And sometimes it's me that's wrong. It's something in me that's wrong. I'm a mess. You know, here we have an alarm, you know, in this building. And for about 4 months, I was the first person on the alarm call list when the alarm went off. We were in between facilities managers, and so I was the number one guy that they called. So about 3 or 4 times a week, I'd get a call, you know, and it's usually Dave Nicholson, right, setting off the alarm usually. One morning, Dave set off the alarm. I got to tell you one short Dave story. I didn't clear this with you, Dave, so you'll just, if you're angry, too bad. But one morning, we get this note in the office, and Dave's here with his discipleship group early in the morning, and he says, I'm sorry, but it's 6:30. I set off the alarm. And when they set off the alarm here, like the whole neighborhood knows, it's like, wah, 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 you know. And he said, I may have also said one or two bad words in the church. So we're still working at kind of cleaning the chairs and everything, but you know, I was the main guy on the call list, and so it had always happened. And you know, like just last night, Ann Hickman's trying to get in, and Ann set the alarm off, and I get this phone call, you know, and it's like, hello, Chip, and in the background I hear, wah, 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 and I know everybody up in Spring Creek knows that our church is open for business. It's kind of like our version of the church bells, you know? So anyway, the point is, when this alarm goes off, you know, you have this big, huge alarm. It makes a big amount of noise. And you want to make sure that the consequences of setting that alarm off are reasonable. And that, because that alarm could go off for something that has to do with me, not to the person that I think I'm angry with. For example, it might be an assumption that I've made, right? It might be my own inconvenience. You know, you have inconvenienced me, and so I am angry with you. So that's my personal. Okay? I'll find it. I'm still looking, okay? But sometimes that anger alarm goes off because it's me. And what I need to do is recognize the alarm's going off, and I need to find out what's wrong. And that might be in my brother, it might be in me, it might be both of us. Second, you need to not let anger act. Commit yourself to not allow anger to either act or speak. Personify anger and just rescind his permission to talk or to take any action or make any decisions. In other words, when you're angry, don't let anger sit in the driver's seat and tell you what to say. Because you know what it will come up with? Haka, you know? Fool, idiot, moron. That's what it'll come up with, or worse. And don't let it act, because you know what it will do? It will insult. It will kill. It will push away. It will destroy. So don't let it make decisions. Just decide that you're not going to let that happen. You know, a while back, there was a guy that had a burglar alarm in his house. Do you remember this? Where he got tired of being robbed. So he set up his front door where when the burglar opened the door, a shotgun was pointed right at the front door. And he opened the door and the shotgun would go off and shoot whoever walked in. And sure enough, burglar broke into his house, opened the door, shotgun went off, shot the burglar. The burglar sued the homeowner for a hazard, you know, a lethal hazard, and won, okay? And now you might be angry about that, okay? If you are, take a deep breath. No, okay. The point is, you know, that's not necessarily a very good burglar alarm, you know, because the consequences are so severe. You know, what if when Ann set off the alarm yesterday, it sent 10,000 volts through the foyer, you know? You know, well, that would take care of nobody breaking into the church, but it's not a really good alarm. In the same way, when the anger alarm goes off in our life, we need to make sure that we're not letting anger act and do whatever it wants to do. Because you know what it'll do? It'll send 10,000 volts of insults through your brother or your sister if you allow it to have voice. When we are angry, we say things and do things that we would not say or do if we were sober. And so don't let anger take control of you. I think that it's one of the examples of the fruit of God's Spirit working in your life called self-control. And in Ephesians, where it talks about that, it says, the works of the flesh are what the flesh produces in me. And guess what one of them is? Outbursts of anger. And over here, the fruit of the Spirit, what the Spirit produces in me, self-control. So don't let anger act. It's not grown up enough to handle the responsibility. Third thing is, that means that sometimes you just need to wait. In other words, take a couple deep breaths and just give it some time. You know, when I'm hot, that's a really bad time for me to deal with the problem. But anger passes away. It diffuses. And so why not wait a little bit and let your emotions calm down and take a few deep breaths and get some perspective about it. And let the emotional part of your anger dissipate so that you can think about the situation and about your response a little bit more objectively and rationally than when you're fuming with anger. You know, not too long ago, I was angry at a staff member, and I had heard that they had done something, and I'm not going to say who it is, and so the main reason is because now, all afternoon, all of them are going to be going, surely not I, it's not I, you know, but I got angry with somebody, and I was pretty angry, because I'd told them not to do something, and then they did it, and so anyway, you know what it turned out, is I was ready to, you know, really let them know that this was not okay and they couldn't be doing this. And then I made a phone call and I found out that they didn't do what I thought they did. Now, am I glad that I didn't call that staff member first? You betcha. You know, because I don't know what I would have said. I mean, I was still, you know, under self-control, but I was angry for no reason. The alarm was going off, but it was somebody else was the intruder. And so waiting is a really good thing because it gives you to go. Yeah. Oh, now you know who the staff member was, right? Okay. Anyway, take a deep breath. Even though this is saying it's urgent to reconcile, sometimes it's better to wait. One example of that is, can you put it away? I think that sometimes things bother me that are best left ignored, if you know what I mean. And because if you bring up every little thing that bothers you or makes you angry, particularly if you're prone to being angry or prone to being bothered, either one, I think bothered is kind of a polite way of saying angry, then what happens if you bring up every little thing, then you spend your entire life in conflict resolution. And you know what? Life is more than conflict resolution. So, for example, if you are married, OK, okay? You certainly have discovered this principle. Either that or you are living in constant conflict, one of the two, okay? Opposites attract. You've all heard that. And what that means is basically that God has designed your spouse to drive you absolutely crazy. That's what that means, okay? They're really different than you are. And so they're going to grate on you all the time, you know? So rather than bring up every little thing that bothers you, I think that sometimes what you do is apply automatic forgiveness and you just ignore it. And you put it in this big box called grace, and then you tuck that box up in the closet where it won't get in the way of our relationship. You know, now I do this, I know you find it hard to believe, but I do this with Julie. And I figure, you know, that's the woman I married, that's the way that she is, and I don't like that particular thing, but I love her even with that. And, you know, the reason that I can tell you that and still go home to sleep in my home this evening is because Julie has to do that same thing with me. And because I'm going to tell you that, that's why I get to go home tonight. And just between us, I'm sure that she has to overlook my faults like a whole lot more often than I have to overlook her faults. So now I get to go home. Okay. So when you find yourself angry, the idea is ask yourself, can I just overlook this? And if you can, I think you put it in the grace box and tuck it away, and then don't let it tear down your relationship. However, sometimes anger is like too big to fit into that little grace box. And sometimes even though we fit it in the box, it kind of pops out on its own. And so if you find that you're still angry, or you find you're angry again, then it probably means that it's time to take action. Now I don't mean to go out and kill them. I mean to go and talk to them to try to resolve this anger or this problem between you. To take the initiative and speak with them and to do it now. Because if the anger's popping back out again, then you need to act right away. And I'd suggest just be as calm as you can be. Don't attack. Just explain. Take responsibility for your own actions. So anything that you did to contribute to the conflict, fess up to. Take responsibility for your own beliefs and your own feelings. In other words, not you made me really angry, but something like, I believe what you did was wrong. Or, I felt angry when you did that. And be willing to listen, as James says, because you might have missed something, and this just might be a huge misunderstanding. Have you ever had that happen to you, where you were angry, and then, you know, you found out what really was happening? It's like, oh, never mind, you know, kind of thing, because you were wrong. I think it's good to be as open as possible to hearing the other person's perspective. And hopefully, as you approach that person with prayer and with a loving attitude, that they will respond well. However, they don't always. There's always a chance that they will not listen to you or that they won't respond in a good way. However, the last point, whether they respond in repentance or whether they stubbornly keep doing the same thing again, there's really only one healthy thing you can do, and that's to forgive them. A lot of times we think of forgiveness as what we're supposed to do when someone apologizes. Like they apologize and then we owe them forgiveness. But you know what? The truth is that forgiveness is really a one-party transaction. It only takes one party to forgive, and that's the person that was offended. Even if somebody is blatantly and stubbornly sinning against you, the very best thing that you can do for yourself and about the situation is to forgive them. You know, somehow we think that if we withhold our forgiveness, that's really going to show them. We're really going to let them have it if we just, I'm not going to forgive them then, okay? And we think that that's really going to hurt them, that they'll really know what pain feels like now because we're not going to forgive them. But you know what really happens is that instead of teaching them, it backfires on us. In reality, we hurt not the other person at all, but we hurt ourselves a great deal. The more that we indulge in anger, the more it consumes us and distorts our perspective of all the rest of our life, the more that it ruins our other relationships, the more that it eats away at our health, the more that it turns us into bitter old men and women. Unresolved anger is a sin, and like all sins, it destroys and it kills. And the reason God tells us to stay away from sin, from anger in this case, is because he doesn't want us to get hurt. And he wants our lives to be great. And this is going to ruin it all. Sometimes you might feel like you're so angry that you could just kill someone. And you know what? Very often, if you feel that way, you can't help it. But it's what you do next that really matters. Because whenever you harbor anger in your heart, Whenever you choose to refuse to forgive, to refuse to reconcile, then the life that's really in danger is your life and not the other person. Let's pray together.